11. Seldom in its missionary endeavours can the Catholic Church in Australia have suffered from so difficult a case as that of Father Flynn. He was a foundling, dumped by an unknown mother at the store of an Irishman at Fitzroy Crossing. At the age of 6 he was sent to the Benedictine Mission at Signet Bay, where he refused to play with other black children, learned to serve at Mass, and had the habit of asking questions about dogma in a soft, reverential brogue. One day he reeled off pat the name of every pope, from St. Peter to Pius XII. The fathers saw this as proof of his craving for Christ. They taught him Latin and encouraged him to take holy orders. He was taken in hand by the mission's oldest inhabitant, an apparently harmless crank, Father Herzog, who had trained as an ethnographer and taught him the rudiments of comparative religion. Flynn was ordained in 1969. He went to Rome. He walked with fellow seminarians in the Alban Hills. He had an audience with the Holy Father, which lasted approximately 1.25 minutes. On his return to Australia, the order decided he should be the first Aboriginal to take charge of a mission on his own. The place they chose was Roe River in the Kimberleys, and to equip himself for the task, Flynn was sent to learn from 2 old-timers, Fathers Subiros and Villaverde, at another Benedictine outpost, Boongaree. Father Subiros, I was later to meet him in the monastery of his retirement, was a sweet-tempered man, short, fat, Catalan, and bookish. Father Villaverde was a leathery extremenen from Trujillo. Together for 50 years they had suffered flood, famine, disease, mutiny, a Japanese bombardment, and many other onslaughts of the devil. Boongaree was an hour's walk from the coast. Roe River, on the other hand, lay 150 miles up country and could be cut off by the wets for 3 months or more. Neither was a mission in the usual sense, but cattle stations, which the order had picked up for a song in 1946, and were intended as refuge areas for tribes whose lands had been taken by the pastoralists, they had proved to be a very sound investment. Coming as he did from the birthplace of the Pizarros, Father Villaverde felt obliged to cast himself in the role of conquistador. He said it was useless to try and impress the heathen with acts of love when all they understood was force. He forbade them to hunt or even to garden. The only hope for their economic salvation was to foster an addiction to horseflesh. He would snatch small boys from their mothers and set them on a bucking saddle. Nothing gave him greater joy than to charge through the bush at the head of his troop of young daredevils. On Saturday afternoons he would preside over a sports meeting with sprinting, wrestling, spear-throwing and boomerang-throwing, and in each event he took part himself. A natural athlete, although in his 70s, he rejoiced at the chance of showing off his superior European physique. The blacks, who knew how to humour him, would hold back their strength, allow him to win, crown him with a victor's wreath, and carry him shoulder-high to his quarters. He banned from the mission all anthropologists, journalists, and other snoopers. He prohibited traditional ceremonies. Above all, with a kind of priestly envy, he resented his lads going off to look for wives. Once they got away, to Broome or Fitzroy Crossing, they picked up foul language, foul diseases, and a taste for drink. So, having done everything to prevent them going, he did everything to prevent them coming back. The blacks believed he was deliberately trying to run down their numbers. I never went to either mission. By the time I got to Australia, they'd been closed for 7 years. I only know of these goings-on from Father Terence, who, when Flynn arrived at Boongaree, was living a mile or so from the compound, in a hut of leaves and branches. Father Villaverde hated Flynn on sight, and put him through every kind of ordeal. He made him wade up to his neck in flood water, castrate bullocks and scrub the latrines. He accused him of eyeing the Spanish nursing sisters at Mass, whereas it was they, poor village girls, sent out in batches from a convent near Badajoz, who had, of course, been eyeing him. One day, as the Spaniards were conducting a Texan cattle king over the mission, the Texan's wife insisted on photographing a white-bearded elder who sat cross-legged and unbuttoned in the dust. The old man was furious. He spat a neat gob of phlegm, which landed at the lady's feet. But she, rising to the occasion, apologized, ripped the film from her camera, and bending forward with the air of Lady Bountiful, asked,
"Is there anything I can send you from America?"
"You can," he snapped. "4 Toyota Land Cruisers."
Father Villaverde was very shocked. To this authentic caballero, the internal combustion engine was an anathema. Someone must have been stirring up trouble. His suspicions fell on Father Flynn. A month or so later, he intercepted a letter from the Department of Aboriginal Affairs in Canberra, thanking the Boongaree Council for their request for a land cruiser. The matter would receive consideration.
"And what," shrieked Father Villaverde, "is the Boongaree Council?"
Flynn folded his arms, waited for the tirade to blow over, and said,
"We are."
From that day on, there was open war. At the next Saturday's sports meeting, just as Father Villaverde had hurled his winning throw, Flynn, in a white soutane, strode out from behind the chapel carrying a spear which had been rubbed with red ochre. He beckoned the spectators to clear a space, and, with an apparently effortless flick, sent the weapon soaring into the air. The length of the throw was over twice that of the Spaniard, who took to his bed in rage. I forget the name of the 3 tribes camped around the mission. Father Terence scribbled them on a scrap of paper, but I lost it. The point to remember is that Tribe A was the friend and ally of Tribe B, and both were blood enemies of the men of Tribe C, who, outflanked and deprived of their source of women, were in danger of dying out. The 3 camps lay equidistant from the mission buildings, each tribe facing the direction of its former homeland. Fights would break out only after a period of taunts and accusations of sorcery. Yet, by tacit agreement, neither of the allies would gang up on their common enemy. All 3 recognized the mission itself as neutral ground. Father Villaverde preferred to condone these periodic bouts of bloodletting. As long as the savages persisted in their ignorance of the gospel, they were bound to go on fighting. Besides, the role of peacemaker suited his vanity. At the sound of screams, he would rush to the scene, stride through the clashing spears, and with the gesture of Christ calming the waters, say, "Stop!" and the warriors would shamble off home. The leading lawman of Tribe C had the unforgettable name of Cheeky Bugger Tabagi. An expert tracker in his youth, he had guided prospecting expeditions through the Kimberleys. He now hated every white man, and in 30 years had not addressed one word to the Spaniards. Cheeky Bugger was built on a colossal scale, but he was old, arthritic, and covered with the scabs of a skin disease. His legs were useless. He would sit in the half-shade of his humpy and let the dogs lick his sores. He knew he was dying, and it enraged him. One by one he had watched the young men go or go to pieces. Soon there would be no one, either to sing the songs or to give blood for ceremonies. In Aboriginal belief, an unsung land is a dead land, since if the songs are forgotten, the land itself will die. To allow that to happen was the worst of all possible crimes, and it was with this bitter thought that Cheeky Bugger decided to pass his songs to the enemy, thereby committing his people to perpetual peace, which, of course, was a far, far graver decision than conniving at perpetual war. He sent for Flynn and asked him to act as mediator. Flynn went from camp to camp, argued, exhorted, and finally arrived at a formula. The snag was one of protocol. Cheeky Bugger had begun the negotiations. In law, it was he who must deliver the songs in person. The question was how. He couldn't walk. He would not be carried. He scoffed at the offer of a horse. In the end, it was Flynn who hit on the solution, by borrowing a wheelbarrow from the Malay cook who worked the kitchen garden. The procession set off between 2 and 3 of a blistering blue afternoon, when the cockatoos were silent and the Spaniards snoring through their siesta. Cheeky Bugger went ahead in the wheelbarrow, pushed by his eldest son. Across his knee, wrapped in newspaper, lay his juringa, which he now proposed to lend to the enemy. The others followed in single file. At some point beyond the chapel, 2 men, from tribes A and B, stepped from the bushes and escorted the party to the place of business. Flynn lagged behind, his eyes half closed, with the air of a man in a trance. He brushed past Father Terence without a flicker of recognition.
"I could see he was off," Father Terence told me, "and I could see we were in for trouble. But it was all very moving. For the first time in my life I had a vision of peace on earth."
Around sunset, one of the nursing sisters took a shortcut through the bush and heard the drone of voices and the tack-tack of boomerangs being clacked together. She hurried to tell Father Villaverde. He rushed out to break up the meeting. Flynn walked out from behind a tree and warned him to stay away. After the fight, people said that Flynn had simply clamped his hands around his attacker's wrists and held them. This, however, did not prevent Father Villaverde from writing letter after letter to his superiors, claiming unprovoked assault and demanding that this acolyte of Satan be drummed from the body of the church. Father Subiros advised him not to send them. Already Aboriginal pressure groups were lobbying for an end to the missions. Flynn had not taken part in a heathenish rite. He had only acted as peacemaker. What if the press got wind of the affair? What if it came out that two elderly Spaniards had been stirring up tribal warfare? Father Villaverde gave in, against his better judgment, and in October 1976, 2 months before the wets, Flynn left to take charge of Roe River. The previous incumbent refused to meet him and left for Europe on sabbatical. The rains came, and there was silence. Sometime during Lent, the Catholic bishop of the Kimberleys radioed Boongaree to confirm or deny a rumour that Flynn had gone native, to which Father Villaverde answered, "He is native." On the first day fit for flying, the bishop flew the Benedictine to Roe River in his Cessna, where they inspected the damage, like two conservative politicians at the scene of a terrorist bomb. The chapel was in disarray. Buildings had been burnt for firewood, the stock pens were empty, and there were charred beef bones everywhere. Father Villaverde said, "Our work in Australia is at an end." Flynn then overplayed his hand. He believed the land rights movement was advancing faster than it was. He counted on the assurance of certain left-wingers that missions all over the country would be handed over to the blacks. He refused to compromise. Father Villaverde trumped him. The affair had touched the church at its most brittle point, the financial. It was not generally known that both Boongaree and Roe River had been financed with capital raised originally in Spain. A bank in Madrid held the title deeds as collateral. To forestall any attempt at confiscation, both missions were sold, secretly, to an American businessman and absorbed into the assets of a multinational corporation. The press campaigned for their return. The Americans threatened to close an unprofitable smelter north of Perth with a loss of 500 jobs. The unions intervened. The campaign subsided. The Aboriginals were dispersed, and Dan Flynn, as he styled himself, went to live with a girl in Broome. Her name was Goldie. In her ancestry were Malay, Koipanga, Japanese, Scot, and Aboriginal. Her father had been a pearler, and she was a dentist. Before moving into her apartment, Flynn wrote a letter in faultless Latin, requesting Holy Father to release him from his vows. The couple moved to Alice Springs and were active in Aboriginal politics.